Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, folks. This is Rob Wolf, your friendly neighborhood podcast host with the Wait, I Thought We Were Glamping edition of New Books in Science Fiction, the podcast where we have fun talking about upbeat things like climate collapse and overpopulation and man's inhumanity to man, which is a bit of what we're going to talk about today. But we're also going to talk about parental love, the wonders of nature, and I'm sure lots of other things. I am delighted today to welcome Diane Cook to the show to talk about her new book, The New Wilderness, which made the Booker Prize long list this year. So congratulations, Diane. And Diane is on the line with me from Michigan right now. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad to be here.
I know that you like to spend a lot of time in the wilderness. That's what your biography said. And in fact, you wrote some of The New Wilderness in the high desert of Oregon while trekking on public lands. And yet in your bio, you say you've always been rooted in cities. And I know you call Brooklyn home right now, although you're not there at the moment. And you also put in your bio that you're easily spooked by being alone in wild places. So how do you fit all those things into one person?
That's a good question. I think weirdly, very easily, because I think I'm drawn to the things that also scare me a little bit. So it makes sense that I'm looking for something that's not as comfortable as the thing I'm used to. So the life I've always lived has been in cities, or like the suburbs immediately around cities, where cities have been like a part of our life. And I've always thought, well, there's got to be more beyond this. There's got to be something else. And that something else is going to be what really attracts me or gets my imagination going. And that turned out to be true. Being in empty places just fascinates me. I think there's something about the expansiveness of those of lands that are empty that make my imagination feel a lot freer than it usually does in a city.
The New Wilderness is about a group of people, the community, who've been allowed to live in, I guess, kind of one of the open spaces, a sort of open space like what you're talking about. But in their case, it's really the last wilderness, and they're allowed to go there as a kind of experiment. And the story centers around one family, a mother bee, her daughter Agnes, and Agnes's father, although I guess I should say stepfather, Glenn. And I thought maybe we could just start there. Maybe you could explain what the community is, how it got to this wilderness, and what's the experiment that they're participating in?
Yeah, so the wilderness state is this last wilderness in the U.S. This is, you know, obviously it's a speculative novel looking ahead and imagining that there's just one wilderness area left and all the other land in the U.S. is spoken for in whatever capacity you can imagine, like whether it's farming or mining or part of this ever-expanding metropolis city where everyone lives. And the reason that these 20 people end up in the wilderness state is under this idea of that they're taking part of in an experiment. And the experiment, it's a hazy kind of experiment, but the experiment has always been explained to them as a thing that is trying to gauge whether people and nature can interact anymore without one destroying the other. And because like that idea that people and are in nature or people belong in nature or people can survive in nature has been like completely lost to history. It's been so long since people spent any time in nature at all. So it's basically a study, but the study takes a backseat to the story of the community in the novel. And the community are these randomly chosen 20 people, and they're not even chosen necessarily. They're all volunteers. It's like a kind of study where nobody really wanted to take part in it because it seemed really hard, because it was really hard. And these 20 people were self-selected for various reasons. They all know why they wanted to go to this place, but it's not like the rest of the world understands why they would want to do a thing like this. So it's a self-selected group. They operate a lot like the office where you might work or some board that you're on or some committee that you're on, where some people you can tolerate, others you can't. So they're all together and they wander around the wilderness area and basically try and live as best they can with each other and within nature. And Bea and Agnes are the main focus of the book. It's a mother and daughter, like you said, and they've come to the wilderness area because Agnes is really sick. The city, the smog in the city makes it hard for kids especially. And she really doesn't have much time left before she succumbs to illness. And Bea knows this, and Bea sees this opportunity, this study, as a way to get her out of the city at great cost to both of them. It's not an easy decision, but it's the only decision that will ensure that she has a fighting chance.
Yeah, I want to talk a little more about Bea and Agnes, but before we do, I thought maybe we could talk just a little bit more about the way the community has to live. And one thing I found intriguing was that they have this thing they call the manual, and it kind of serves as this rigid set of rules that they also keep kind of ignoring, but then they'll go back to it sometimes, or sometimes the rangers who show up at random times and are supposedly enforcing the rules of the manual and protecting the wilderness, and I suppose playing a role in conducting the experiment, they'll show up and make them follow the rules. And there's kind of this push-pull with these rules. They're very rigid rules. I mean, they are supposed to pick up every last scrap of garbage. They're not supposed to leave a trace at all of their presence. And so one of the rules is they can only stay in one place for 7 days, technically, but they hardly ever follow that rule because it's so impractical. And when they leave a place, they have to do micro trash sweeps to get every last drop. I mean, it's really intense. And one thing that struck me was that it kind of goes counter to the flow of nature. I mean, you know, if you're in the wilderness and you find a place, say, where food is abundant, well, historically, I think man has settled there and said, hey, this place works for us. Let's stay here for a while until the food runs out. But the manual is dictating that you can't do that. We don't want the food to run out. And so it's sort of almost saying, try to survive in the wilderness, but don't follow the rules of the wilderness. Don't dominate in any way. It's almost like nature. Let nature be the dominant one and not man, which is very counter to history. Anyway, that's a lot of different ideas, I guess, but I felt like it was kind of embodied in the manual and their relationship to the manual.
Yeah, those are great ideas. And it's a lot of what I was thinking about. I mean, I've, you know, spent a lot of time hiking and like leading groups of students out into the woods. And every time I go to any kind of, you know, national forest or state forest or anywhere where we're spending the night in the woods, there are a lot of rules to follow. And they're there for a reason. counterintuitively, they're there to protect this thing that otherwise seems wild. Like I think it's would the word be oxymoronic? I don't know. I forget what the definition of that word is or how to use it correctly. But there's like a real tension. There's a real tension between the idea that they're sent to this place to kind of devolve back into something natural, and yet the only way that they're allowed to stay is by following all these rigid rules. And I think that that is something that I'm kind of playing with in the whole spectrum of what it means to be human versus what it means to be animal, or more, you know, of a more natural state. We're pushed toward this more civilized end of a spectrum by the rules that we make, and we can't be trusted to engage or interact with the world around us without this rigid set of rules, like keeping us in check. And yeah, they were just, the tension was something that I found really interesting, and it made a lot of sense to me, both in its absurdity, like it's almost like Kafka-esque absurdity, but also in that that is actually how we interact with wilderness areas. A lot of those rules, those rigid rules, are actually just rules like you could pull out of any wilderness guide, you know, like leave no trace. You're supposed to pick up after yourself. And the rule for the community in the book is just like it's not even that extreme of a version of it. It's like micro trash is a thing and you're supposed to pick it up and you're supposed to only camp certain amount, you know, a certain distance from water. And I know that there are rules of how long you can stay in one place when you're backcountry camping. I don't know what the timeline is. I made up my own timeline, but these are my rules in the manual, the rules of the novel. I mean, the rules of the novel and the rules of the manual are just kind of a heightened and maybe not even so heightened version of the rules that already exist for people when they're engaging with the natural world in a place like the United States. And I'll just add, like, it isn't even a commentary on it that I think it's, you know, a negative. Like, it's just an essential set of rules because humans are so unruly. You know, like, we're all so individualistic that we need a lot more guidance than, you know, when we're set out into places that aren't used to supporting our presence.
Well, I guess the course of human civilization is to just kind of take over the wilderness, just like the book says. And the only way to stop it is to impose rules. I mean, you're making me think that the manual is also a metaphor for the rules of the EPA and the rules of any agency that's saying you can't dump, you can't pollute here, and you got to keep this clean. And because if we don't, it ends up getting ruined.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really interesting mess of a reality that we need all these rules to behave and to not destroy what's around us. And the rules sometimes feel burdensome or even unfair, but they also are totally necessary, I mean, in my mind. And I liked playing around with, I'm very interested in rules, like in all of my writing, even outside of this novel, I'm very interested in rules and how people either accept or reject them. So it was inevitable to me that I would have a manual in my novel and that people would be, the characters would constantly be kind of in conversation with this text of rules that seems absurd, but is actually the only thing keeping the community from not, like, basically building a town and planting a garden.
Another interesting thing is that the 20 members of the community, the initial 20 members, my sense is they just kind of got thrown into the wilderness. So on the one hand, they have this manual of rules, but they didn't really have any particular training or preparation, like how to start a fire by rubbing two sticks together or how to make this or that. They all kind of came more or less from the city with their kind of urban understanding, and they just kind of had to figure it out. I mean, people come in even without the proper clothes. Some buy the L.L. Bean-esque proper boots, but it seems like other people just came with the clothes on their back, and more or less, and they just kind of have to sink or swim.
Yeah. There's like a couple different waves. The original group, there's like a reference to some kind of intake that they did. But yeah, like I think I always imagined that the people who came wanted to be there and so did the kind of research that they felt they needed to do. But it was all kind of self-starting. There wasn't this like big orientation where they got all of the skills that they needed. There's kind of this unspoken rule. I mean, maybe unspoken within the novel, but a rule that I knew existed among the Rangers and the community. The Rangers are like the kind of the enforcing group, that the Rangers don't help the community. Like there's this idea, almost like you might see in a reality show, that they don't get involved or interfere, because that would undermine the experiment itself. So they have to come and they have to figure it out on their own, out of kind of a moment of necessity. And sometimes they don't figure it out, and the group of 20 does not stay a group of 20 for long.
No, and that's another interesting thing, is that in some ways they get hardened rather quickly, it seems to me, or at least some of them do. I mean, when one character dies suddenly as they're trying to cross a river, B gets very impatient with people having almost any feeling about it. Like, okay, come on, you know, let's stop talking about her, you know? And then, I mean, a ranger says to her something like, you know, when she has to report updates, when they check in, something like, she was very impatient and he sounds sad. And he goes, well, when did this happen? Well, yesterday. It's like, well, just yesterday? Like, and you already are, you want to move on? So that's also obviously perhaps a defense and a coping mechanism, maybe showing actually a depth of feeling she doesn't want to deal with. But it's certainly interesting what the environment and being in the wilderness does to the individuals.
Yeah. And I think, you know, and it, you can see a lot of who the individuals are. B is a particular kind of person, and she's a little more prickly than the rest, and a little more impatient, and there are some things that she has a lot of time for and a lot of capacity to feel things about, and there are some things that she does not. But beyond her own particular sense of self and sense of community is this idea that the longer they're there and the more that they see and the more loss they experience and the farther they get from what's normal in a society, the less time they have for the theater of grief, I guess, a demonstration of their feeling. And it's more like there's not a lot of space and time for that kind of thing when every day you're just surviving. I wanted to make things a little more extreme than they might be in a real situation in this book, because I think, like you pointed out earlier, a good place for a group of people to stop, or a place with a lot of food or a good opportunity for safe survival, you would just stop and be there. So that would be a natural thing to do. But there's something not natural about the way they're having to live. And I wanted that to kind of infiltrate into every part of them. So they would learn that they would need to deal with grief a little differently in the wilderness. But it ends up looking something like this, where it almost feels a little heartless. And there's a passage in another section where they talk about that evolution, how they came to be people who felt righteously indignant when they see a group like a deer herd reject a baby, you know, like a fawn, and not take care of the fawn after its mother has died or abandons it. and the fawn itself dies, and they're so angry because it's early on and they still have this sense of humanity about them. And then as time goes on and they experience more and more loss, they start to see that example as being a little different. And I just liked playing with their changing grasp on what the right and wrong ways to behave would be the longer they stayed in this place.
Well, let's talk about what happens with Bea and Agnes a little bit. I mean, they are the main characters in the heart of the book, and I suppose they have as complicated a relationship as maybe any mother and daughter. So Agnes, as you said, was dying because of the pollution in the city, and that's why Bea wanted to bring her to the wilderness. And you can tell that Agnes is the most important thing to Bea, and yet I think, like a lot of parents, you know, Bea also experiences moments of ambivalence. In prioritizing Agnes's life, she has to deprioritize her own at times, and initially she resents having to leave the city, but she still does it. So there's this tension, I guess, that you're always feeling, that ultimately Bea is trying and always basically doing right by Agnes in some fundamental way, but Agnes doesn't experience it that way, and as children often don't, and doesn't always see the extent to which Bea is making sacrifices. And it's not always clear, you know, I mean, it's kind of like a tough love sometimes. That's what it feels like. So I wonder if you could just talk a little bit about your vision of their relationship and how maybe it changes and evolves, what this environment does to it that's different than what might otherwise have happened, you know, if they had stayed in the city and I guess Agnes had lived.
Yeah, I mean, I think you describe it really, really well, the kind of the natural state of their relationship. And they're a mother and daughter. And I think partly in thinking about what their relationship would have been if she'd just stayed in the city and Agnes had, you know, somehow been okay, I'm not sure it would have been that different. I think their relationship would still have some of this tension. And I think that's partly what I wanted to play around with. Again, like the wilderness state is this very extreme place and this very extreme situation. And so it pushes everyone to a very extreme version of how they would just normally be anyway. I think Bea and Agnes would have the same kinds of misunderstandings and inabilities to communicate and the inabilities to kind of really understand where the other's coming from, just like they do in the wild, but the stakes would feel less, you know, the stakes would be softened in the city, and it would feel, you know, like maybe my relationship with my mom felt, which we had a fine relationship. We had a good relationship even, but I know that we both felt like we didn't totally get the other. And so to put Agnes and Bea into such an extreme situation, I think it really blows up that problem that people have. And I think mothers and daughters, but also lots of people. There are a couple of different instances in the book where, you know, someone says something about themselves and the, you know, the person we're following, the, you know, kind of the, it's told in third person, like close third person, the person that we're with at that time, whether it's Bea or Agnes, kind of makes a comment to themselves like, oh, I didn't know that about that person. And these are people who've lived together in a very extreme situation for years at this point. But I think that there's just a way that that happens among people, whether it's daughters and mothers or just members of a group. There's just things that we just don't or can't know about one another. And I wanted to have it be a real part of their lives.
Obviously, you've spent time in the wilderness and you've spent time alone in the wilderness. And I wonder how that has informed your appreciation of the dwindling nature in the United States and the world and how it informed the ideas for the novel. You know, I can't help but think, I don't know if you saw today the pictures from San Francisco all day. The sky was completely orange all day.
Yeah.
From the fires.
And parts of Oregon where I spent time. It's just awful. Yeah, I mean, in another world, I would be a nature writer. It's just where I get my inspiration from. And I don't even have to be in the middle of nowhere. I can be like looking at a tree in the city and it gives me ideas. I read a lot of nonfiction about the natural world and it always gives me ideas. But I don't like write. I don't want to just be a nature writer. Like I want to write fiction. I want to build worlds. I want to make shit up. So the landscapes, I want to like bring them into my fiction. And so it makes sense, at least with this project, to try and create a world where my characters didn't just like happen upon some natural settings and ponder them, you know, like where someone is in the middle of some kind of drama that doesn't have anything to do with trees, but then they look at a tree and they have a thought. You know, I didn't want to write that kind of fiction. I wanted to write fiction where people couldn't get away from nature, where nature was as much a character as the characters who were driving the novel. And all of that gives me an excuse to just go spend a lot of time in these places that I love to be, or to go wandering around and trying to find things that inspire me or things I've never seen before. Things that seem strange and alien to me because I grew up in the Midwest. Being out in the high desert wasn't even the kind of landscape that I imagined when I first had the idea for the book. I'd never seen a landscape like it. But once I was there, I knew that I wanted to spend years just thinking about how to get the landscape down on the page.
And do you see yourself as someone who will continue to write this kind of speculative fiction? Or, I mean, you know, this podcast is called New Books in Science Fiction, but that encompasses a lot of different things, including, I think, your book. But what's your view of yourself as a writer in terms of what you see yourself writing more of in the future? I do know, I haven't read your short stories, but your prior book was a collection of short stories. It was called Man v. Nature. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah.
My understanding of what I read about it was that there are a lot of nature stories, but I didn't know if they were necessarily speculative stories.
Yeah, some speculative or apocalyptic. Some have a kind of fabulous turn to them. So it's just like a little bit of magical realism in them. So yeah, I think most people would use like dystopian, apocalyptic, surreal to describe some of the stories. And yeah, I don't even always know the difference between all of these terms. Dystopian and speculative often seem like they have to be the same thing, at least these days. I mean, I think that I won't be happy writing about our world as it exists now in our current time. I just think that I'm not built to do that. I like world building. And in any fiction you write, even if it's auto fiction about right now, there's world building to be done. But I like really building my worlds. I like making them from the ground up. I think it's an exciting way to write. I think it's it makes me so energized and excited to do that kind of work over just kind of trying to capture the world around me in some way that feels realist. So I can't imagine I won't be doing some kind of speculative writing or you know, as with the short stories, some kind of writing where it takes a fantastical or fabulous turn at some point. I like writing about ideas. And I think that changing the world and building a new world and activating characters within that world, it just lends itself to exploring ideas better. I don't know if that make sense, or if that's something that you found, it just clears the way of all the detritus of what is in our lives every day. And it lets us see things on a kind of not a clean slate, but a new slate. And so we're just able to pay attention to the ideas more. And I just find that much more exciting to work in.
Yeah, I can even relate to that myself. And I think writing about a speculative future, near future, far future, it always ends up reflecting back on how we live today anyway. But I find it a great way to do that rather than literally writing about the now, but sort of speculating about, you know, the next steps from now and what might happen and what could happen. I have one other question, and it's about the title, actually, and why you decided to call it The New Wilderness rather than just, say, The Wilderness. You know, in a way, in a sense, the wilderness is the oldest thing in this world, and it isn't actually new, but I can imagine lots of ways to think of why it was new to these people in the story, but what was your thinking behind the title?
I mean, I had lots of thoughts, and there were other titles, you know, working titles at different points. Like at one point it was called The Wilderness State, and another point it was called, way back when, a totally different, you know, idea was kind of the main engine for the premise. It was called The Mitigation State. But The New Wilderness, I think, gave it a little more breadth. It made it feel a little more expansive to me, because I think throughout the course of the book, there are new places that they encounter and new characters who become important to the plot and to the people in the book. There are a lot of changes that happen throughout the book. They go to a lot of places. Their realities change a lot throughout the book. I'm thinking especially of someone like Agnes. And I really liked the idea that the wilderness, I mean, here, I'll also say throughout the course of the book, and one of the big inspirations for the book is just the nature of wilderness itself as an idea, as a construct, and the idea that there could be a new wilderness or a new kind of wilderness or something that's a wilderness to one person and not to another. Was really interesting to me and made a lot of sense to me. And by the end, there's an idea of wilderness that I think is very different than the idea of wilderness that the story begins in. And so it made sense to me that there was this progression and an evolution, not just in the people, but in the idea of this place itself. Plus, it sounds good, I think.
It does. It sounds excellent. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Diane. I've really enjoyed talking to you about The New Wilderness. And I thank you so much for taking the time to be on New Books in Science Fiction.
Oh, thank you so much for asking me. I never imagined that this book would qualify as science fiction, since it's all about, it's like zero technology and people just wandering around with primitive tools. But I love the idea that it could be considered that.
Well, there are lots of futures that people have envisioned that may very well be in our future.
I know. Yeah, I mean, that isn't exciting to me, but it's exciting that this book fits into that whole world. So thank you very much.
Well, you're welcome. I mean, that's... Yes. Not that I get to make that decision. Like, I bless your book as a science fiction book. But yes, that's how it seemed to me. And I love the breadth and diversity of what science fiction can be. And that's why one of the many reasons I love doing the podcast, most of all, to speak to fascinating writers who have all kinds of interesting things to say, like you did today.
Great. Well, thank you very much. I loved it. You have great questions. So thank you so much.
Thank you. I have been talking to Diane Cook about her novel, The New Wilderness, which came out in August from Harper. Thanks for listening to this episode of New Books in Science Fiction. Please subscribe and leave a review to show your support if you haven't done that already. Michael Aaron of QuiverNYC.com composed our lovely theme music. I'm Rob Wolf, author of The Alternate Universe. I edit each episode. But the show wouldn't get to you without the incredible New Books Network and its endlessly innovative founder and editor, Marshall Poe, and his dedicated co-editor, Leanne Wilson. I'll be back in a few weeks with a new episode. Until then, I really hope the air is fresh where you are, and I do hope you wear a mask when you're around others. Bye for now.